I hope you're going to have an amazing time in New York, too. I will admit, when we first talked about me keeping the kids all summer, I imagined you a 5-minute drive away in case I got in over my head. But that's not fair to you. Believe it or not, I do really want you to be happy. Also, this is very awkward to talk about over email, but I don't think you'd appreciate it as a phone call either. So I want you to know that things have ended between me and Marika. They have been ended for a long time. I just got the credit card statement and put 2 and 2 together, and I'm sorry for the stress I probably caused by not taking her card off the account. I took care of it yesterday. Anyway, that relationship was an aberration. I've been single otherwise. I intend to spend that extra energy where it belongs from here on out on my family. Okay, have fun in New York. Give my love to Talia. John. When I tell Talia I want to come back to New York, she tells me it's a damn good thing because she needs a house sitter ASAP. Then she says something about how when you take positive steps in your life, the universe rewards you by making your path forward easier. I ask her what positive steps she's taking, and she says, "I'm talking about you, dummy." I think of John's email. Was his ending his relationship with Marika a gift from the universe? If so, I don't feel terribly grateful, just more confused. The universe has provided you with a 1.5-bedroom apartment all to yourself for the summer. The universe seems to have different things in mind for me, Talia adds. Hot, sweaty things. Apparently, she tells me, the pure beautiful demographics are terrible in the South. The ad sales guys say we're too Yankee. We need a better handle on real America. What fashion magazine has a handle on real America? I ask her, and she says, that's what I told them. And they told me to take a skeleton crew to Miami. As if that's any more real, to work up 3 winter issues and run magazine events. I can see she isn't a fan of this idea. She loves New York, and maybe, just maybe, thinks that civilization ends at the Hudson. You might, I tease, actually like it there. Maybe, she replies. But while I'm gone, consultants will be climbing all over the office, trying to figure out how to get this magazine to make money. And the solution might not involve the actual magazine itself, she explains. Paper and ink only have so much time left. This assignment out of town means that whatever is next for Pure Beautiful, my pretty little print edition might not be a part of it. My face falls. But then what will you do? I ask her, worried. Talia winks at me. Don't you worry, Ames. I can always call Simon. I blanch at the mention of her filthy rich but otherwise unexciting ex. She smirks. I have a contract. I will come out okay. Move over to online eventually. It's inevitable. I'm just enjoying the last days of disco while I can. I shake my head. Don't go. Stay and fight for the magazine. But she packs up and leaves, promising to come back for a weekend, and tells herself soothingly, no one spends August in New York anyway. And then she laughs and adds, well, Amy Byler does. And like that, she is gone. It sets me back on my heels to know Talia's job isn't carved in stone. It was easy to tell myself that Talia's life was simply perfect in every way. And honestly, she did make a single, child-free life seem pretty wonderful. But of course, she isn't the master of her own destiny any more than I am. She answers to people. She takes her lumps. She just looks much better while doing it. So suddenly, I am on my own in New York. The beauty, and maybe just the tiniest curse, too, of single parenting is that you are never, ever alone for more than 3 consecutive hours. On the rare evenings when I would go out without the kids, I'd meet up with Lena or another friend, and we'd chatter nonstop over wine. If Corey was out at night, I was with Joe at a tournament or home grading homework while he and his friends played Settlers and ate pizzas. If Joe went to a friend's on a Saturday, Corey and I were at the movies watching stuff that would make Joe fall asleep before the opening credits were over, or she was hitting me up for a ride somewhere. Corey would go out every night, if not for my school night policies, but Joe is a homebody. I always had company. Now, for the first time, it's just me, completely alone. All day talk to no one alone, if I want to be. I will have time to just have uninterrupted thoughts, time to reflect, or time to have fun, time to work out until I'm pumped full of endorphins, find the best bagel in Brooklyn, have white wine lunches on downtown sidewalks, and visit every gorgeous library and bookstore in this enormous city. I can take my beautiful hair and my beautiful clothes out on big adventures. I can wander in and out of the shops in Soho without feeling like an imposter. I can flirt with baristas. I can read in the park. I can do whatever the hell I want for an entire summer. Whoa. I flop down on Talia's guest bed, stunned, and think, okay, Amy, what's the first thing I want to do with all this freedom? Chinatown? The Cloisters? A ride on the Staten Island Ferry? Nope, nope, nope. One thing tops my to-do list, or rather, one person. One very hot librarian. When it comes to writing back Daniel, my first instinct is not dissimilar to my teen daughter's. I want to message Lena, Talia, Corey, and maybe even Matt to run through the thousands of different interpretations of his Facebook message and the further thousands of different ways to write him back. But there is something else guiding me too, something quiet and still and sure. When I sent Daniel packing the morning after our date slash one night stand, I felt a strange mix of victory and shame with a tinge of fear over the top. Now things are different. I'm not in New York for a week. I'm here for almost 3 months. I have time to do everything I desire. And my heart desires a hot librarian. And I've decided it's totally safe to pursue that desire. Daniel has a teenager in arguably the best high school in New York and a great job here too, and therefore is not a genuine threat to my emotional safety. There is zero chance we will have a long-term relationship. He is, if he's interested in me, the safest possible summer fling a girl could ask for. So instead of debating and delaying and generally distracting myself from something that might make me happy, I decide to just write him back like a grown woman. I open his message. You kick me out of bed at the crack of dawn, and the only way to track you down is to follow the clues from a trending topic on Twitter? Now I know how Prince Charming felt. Hashtag glass Twitter. And I type back, sorry, Your Charming Highness, but I had a major freakout after our little night out. Was feeling weird because of the impossibility of our situation. Me going back to PA, you in NYC. Since then, my plans have changed, and now I'm spending the rest of the summer in Brooklyn. Forgive me? I hit enter and close my laptop. I think that I'll be waiting a day, or 3 days, or whatever the standard rules are, before I hear back. But 10 minutes later, my phone sends me a Facebook alert. Daniel replies, agreed. Situation totally impossible. But I think it would still be fun to hang out while you're here. Plus, I have a ton of ideas for your flexology. Meet up next week at a quiet, bookish pub on the Upper West Side. I decide if he's not going to be coy, then I won't have to be either. Absolutely, I write. Send me the time and place. Then after a few minutes, I add, can't wait. There, look at me. I am the ultimate sophisticate. Just casually making plans with a man I intend to sleep with outside of the bounds of a formal relationship. I am a modern woman. I am Gloria Steinem and Helen Gurley Brown and the slutty one from Sex and the City all wrapped up in one. But when we meet up, all my best laid plans quickly go down the drain. The dead author is a long, skinny, deep bar, a pool table in the way back that barely has clearance for a pool cue, a broken jukebox full of dusty AC/DC and Smashing Pumpkins records, and three high top tables, one in the front, two in the back. The ceiling is made up of pages of novels torn out and affixed, well, remotely, by way of pencils and darts. I'm not sure how they stay stuck, but they do. The ceiling is so high, I cannot tell which book pages are up there, mangled and stabbed through the heart. But the big dark wood bar seems to be set onto bookcases, and when I hoist myself up to it, my feet kick at a row of titles. At random, I reach under the bar and pull a book out. It is a worn copy of The Catcher in the Rye. Ugh. I pull out another. Also Catcher in the Rye, different cover, different print date. Unable to resist, I climb off the stool and look at the upper shelf of books. I'd estimate they are 75% Catcher in the Rye. Another 20% are Franny and Zoe. The remaining 5% seem to be a completely random collection of nonsense books released roughly 30 years ago. Fishing guides and church cookbooks and gothic romances. Huh. Well, then, I guess I'll read Catcher in the Rye. I open it up, read the iconic first line, inwardly groan, and then stare off into space, hoping for Daniel to show himself soon. It is probably sacrilege to say it, but I don't even assign Catcher in the Rye to students anymore. It hasn't, to my mind, aged well. Now, David Copperfield? There's a book I could read for hours in a bar. I take out my journal and write, Perks of Being a Wallflower versus Catcher. And then write, David Copperfield Modern Rewrites? I hope the entries make sense to me when I go to do lesson planning in August. After a few more moments go by, the bartender visits me. What can I get you? She asks, and I realize I've been sitting there for 10 minutes without paying any rent on my bar stool. I look past her at the wall of bottles behind her. Aha! There is an entire row of different rye whiskeys. All becomes clear. I guess I'll have a Manhattan, I tell her. It's the only rye drink I know. She tilts her head at me ever so slightly. Anything you like with malt whiskey can be made with rye. Oh yeah? Like a whiskey sour? That's pretty good, actually. The original way it was made. Which rye? She asks. I shrug. Surprise me. She pulls down a pretty bottle and a shot glass and pours me a tiny taste. Whistle Pig, she tells me. I sip it, try not to cough, and nod at her. It tastes good, I lie. It tastes like a cross between nail polish remover and caramel sauce. This your bar?
Yep.
Open it in 2010?
Yep. How'd you know?
It's called The Dead Author. Salinger wasn't dead until 2010. She points to a sign.
Just saved yourself $4, she tells me.
Happy hour, 50% off for nerds until 7 p.m., reads the sign. I laugh. How do you know if someone's a nerd? I ask her. She puts a drink in front of me.
They always make themselves known. Want to start a tab?
Daniel walks into the bar just at that moment. My heart stumbles. Yes, I do. And make another one of these for that good-looking dork, I tell her. She winks at me.
My, but that's a sexy nerd, she says. Have fun.
Daniel pulls up a bar stool next to me. He's wearing a pair of jeans and a plain brick-red t-shirt and carrying a large messenger bag across his chest. His shirt pulls just a bit across the shoulders, but is loose around the waist. He looks like the dad from a diversely cast CW show. In short, dreamy.
Sorry I'm late,
he says, as I try to figure out if we're going to hug or kiss or something in greeting. Maybe not kiss. I reach an arm toward him, but the bar stools are too far away. In the end, we share an awkward high five. I laugh nervously. He is awfully good looking. Your timing is perfect, I tell him when I recover. I was earning us the 50% off. I wave to the happy hour signage. He smiles and nods his head.
Good work. As I was walking up here, I thought maybe I should have told you about that in advance, so you wouldn't go incognito, nerd.
But then I realized there was little danger of that.
Ha! Thanks a lot. You're the one who was seduced by a day at the bookstore.
I wasn't seduced, I say. Then I think it over. Okay, maybe I was seduced a little. Daniel smiles at me with the corner of his mouth.
Mamie,
he says.
Yes? It's great to see you again. I'm glad I tracked you down.
Me too.
And I'm glad you said what you did about our situation being impossible. It's good to just have that out there. You have a life in one place, and I have a life in another. Romance isn't in the cards.
Well, I say. Yeah. Wait, isn't it? Daniel looks at me strangely.
You are going back to PA at the end of the summer, right?
I nod. Right? Yes, but that's a couple months away. I suddenly feel foolish. So I was just sort of thinking, what was I thinking? That we'd have a summer fling and then shake hands goodbye when I went back to my real life? That doesn't sound very flattering to him.
I mean, I don't want to just be a summer fling,
he says, eerily reading my mind.
That would be hard on me.
It would? I mean, yes. Right. I am pretty lost in this conversation. Except, you know, I think you're the one who initiated our very fling-like one-night stand, if we're going to be historically accurate.
Obviously, historical accuracy is of the utmost importance,
he says playfully. He doesn't seem to be the slightest bit uncomfortable in this labyrinthine discussion.
The difference then, though, was I didn't know you were on Mom Springa.
Oh, for that matter, neither did I. He smiles, and even in the midst of all this forthright conversation, it is so overwhelmingly charming when he smiles.
And if you'll forgive me for being indelicate, I also didn't know we'd have such good chemistry.
He makes a weird little slow motion coming together gesture with his hands.
You know, horizontally speaking.
I feel my face get hot. That was above average, right? I don't have much to compare it to lately. He tips his head back.
That was way above average. That was some exceeds expectations level sex.
E-sex? I ask, catching his Hogwarts grading rubric reference.
E, possibly O,
he volleys back.
Anyway, if you ask me, there's no use in trying to casually date someone you have outstanding sex with. It has to be all or nothing.
I sigh. I guess that means it will be nothing. But then why did you message me on Facebook? I ask. He frowns.
To keep in touch, of course.
As friends, I ask.
Right, exactly. Hang out with a cocktail.
He raises his glass to me.
Talk books. Enjoy each other's company.
But that's what we did last time, I say. And look what happened. He nods emphatically.
Good point. We will have to make an effort to keep our clothes on in the future.
Or, I say, already surprised at what's about to come out of my mouth, we could just see what happens. Daniel sobers a bit.
No, really. I don't meet a lot of women I have so much in common with, who also are so...
His voice drifts off.
When you went home, back to your family, I'd be left in the lurch. I think I'd get hurt in that scenario.
I can tell he means it, so I back off, disappointed as I am. Okay, then it's clothes on, for sure.
Can't have me slinking out of every hotel in New York City this summer.
He jokes. Can't we?
I think.
That wouldn't be good, I lie. Besides, I still want your ideas for my reading program. He grins.
You do? I am so, so glad because I have so many ideas. I brought my laptop and it's bursting with suggestions. Should we go snag a table and dig in?
I think about the pretty lacy underthings hiding beneath my casual knit dress and sigh inwardly. Sure, let's dig in. I say in as just friendly a voice as possible.
Let's talk about literacy.
We take our drinks and move to a bar height two-top between the bar and the pool table. Daniel pulls out his laptop to display an impressive spreadsheet of titles, copyright situations, grade levels, and central themes. For an hour, we talk about teaching and reading levels and book canons. And the entire time, two of my brain cells are having a little private argument in the back of my brain. Brain cell one is definitely the devil.
What the hell? She's supposed to be having sex with this one,
it keeps shouting. And brain cell two says, shh, this is perfect. A romantic relationship would be dead in the water in months. He might not be the only person getting hurt. And then brain cell one says, in a huff,
what a waste. Look at him. He's like a high eight, maybe a nine. A New York 8.5. That's a Pennsylvania 4,000.
Brain cell two remains firm. He's too attractive and too smart and too thoughtful. She can have a fling with anyone. This one, it's better to enjoy as a friend.
A friend? I believe it was Shakespeare who wrote, 'Tis better to have sexed and lost than never to have sexed at all, says brain cell one.
And you call yourself a librarian, says brain cell two. You need to get your butt to the 820 shelves, stat.
What I need, I hear myself say out loud, out of absolutely nowhere, is a book on neurology.
My two guilty brain cells shut up. Daniel looks at me quizzically.
Sorry, I say. I think I've hit a wall in my contemplations.
He nods knowingly, though, thankfully, he has no idea what I'm talking about.
I hear you. I've been absolutely piling it on. But believe it or not, I think we have a starting place here. Look at this. 5 different graduated level flexologies covering all of your theme areas. If we can somehow get free permission for these or find money to buy them from the publishers, we'd have enough to run a larger scale pilot program. We put out the word and charters and privates will line up to be in that pilot.
The problem is, I say, challenged but not defeated. We'd be asking schools to pay for e-copies of books, of which 75% or more of the students would read only a chapter. It'll never fly. To say nothing of the fact that very few schools have enough e-readers to institute this, that pigeonholes us with the wealthiest schools. If we don't run the pilot program at less affluent schools, how will we know if it can really reach kids in need?
Daniel frowns.
Maybe.
But then he falters.
You're right. Urban schools are poor, and we already own 100 copies of The Scarlet Letter.
Fat lot of good that does anyone, I say.
I hate The Scarlet Letter.
Daniel smiles.
Careful who hears you say that. In some pedagogical circles, you would be forced to wear a red H for heretic on your dress.
I smirk. Daniel, you may look cool, but deep down, you're a book dork like the rest of us. He perks up.
You think I look cool?
I do, I tell him.
Would you like to do something cool with me?
Like sex? Asks my brain.
Like what?
Asks my mouth.
It's summer in New York City,
he tells me.
The options are endless. But I was thinking...
Yeah?
Ta-da!
He says with a flourish. And then out of his breast pocket, he presents 2 tickets.
How do you feel about baseball?
My eyes go wide. Baseball was probably the last thing on my mind when I thought of tonight. And yet, now that I've had time to contemplate it, I cannot think of anything more perfect for this gorgeous, sunny summer evening than sitting next to this smart, interesting, and very attractive man having a light beer and a hot dog in City Field. My better angel must be getting through to me, because I start to see the reason of having this thing with Daniel be just friends. I'm not divorced yet, and a tiny, stupid, useless part of me doesn't want to be, so I have a steamer trunk full of husband baggage. I could have casual sex with anyone. With a decent human being like Daniel, friendship really does make sense. I feel like baseball is a wonderful reason to sit outside in the sunshine with a new friend. I tell him.
You're gonna look dazzling in a Mets cap, he tells me.
I beam.
Amy, I'm so glad we met.
My mouth goes a little dry.
Me too, I say.
I know I've been needing to make new friends for a long time, he tells me, but single parenting a teenager and working long hours with my students have left me low on social opportunities. And then here you are, on your mom's Springer.
That's not a real thing, I tell him. It's just a word my friend's magazine coined to sell copies.
Here you are, on your mom's Springer,
he repeats as if I haven't spoken.
And you love your kids and your books, and you are so freaking easy to talk to, and you like baseball, he adds.
I shake my head. I do not like baseball. I mean, I might like baseball, but I have no idea if I do or not, because I've never seen a game before. I like doing new things, though, and I like doing them outside on a day like today. And I like doing them with you, I think to myself.
Good enough for me, he exclaims. I'm going to buy you some peanuts and Cracker Jacks.
Well, he admits,
either peanuts or Cracker Jacks. I'm a public school teacher after all. Let's not get crazy.
We wouldn't want that, I say with a smile. In the basement of a department store on Fifth Avenue, there is a tea house where ladies go to lunch on forbidden rice and shrimp balls and arugula dumplings and other tasty yet unsatisfying foodstuffs. Thanks to the magazine expense account, Matt and I have come here 3 times since I got back to New York. It is chock-a-block with media people who are happy to pay a dollar for every 10 calories. Sometimes on the walk back to the magazine, I eat one of those giant street pretzels with mustard to fill up. I am munching on $24 worth of 7-grain porridge and seaweed when Matt tells me he's made a private Pinterest board full of dating options.
Oh,
I exclaim, because I am getting to know Matt well enough to know that there is no point in wasting time discussing what an insane thing that was to do.
Can I see?
He hands it to me. It's a sea of very nice-looking guys, but they are ranging in age from 35 to 50.
Matt, I say solemnly, you can see that these men are all way too old for you, right?
Matt chokes on the microscopic sea cucumber pickle he's nibbling.
Those guys?
He coughs.
For me? No, besides I'm seeing someone. I'm talking about for you.
I say. In my head, I am recalculating the sheer quantity of good-looking guys Matt showed me. A couple of them were downright hot. Would going on a date with one of them be that bad? But come on, Amy, be serious. That's a pity, because I am not interested in going out with complete strangers who were selected for me by someone I've known for 2 weeks. Matt shrugs and puts his phone away. I feel my heart sink a little when he gives in so easily. Maybe I do want to see a few of those cute guys' pictures again, just in case.
Okay, he says. What's the plan for the summer then? That librarian guy you were telling me about?
I level him a look. The plan for the summer is house-sitting for your boss until she gets back, making some book choices for my reading program, and reaching out to authors about using selections from their books for free. And I'm going to read these. I open my Litzy app and show Matt the huge to-be-read shelf I have going.
That's like 30 books, Matt says.
You're right. I may need to add more, I tell him with a smile.
You know, when you have that many books, you'll probably need someone to help you shelve them. Someone like a hot librarian?
I shrug. If you must know, I went out with a hot librarian. We decided to be just friends. Matt tilts his head.
Is he less hot up close?
Oh, my stars. He just gets hotter the closer you get. He is tall, dark, and handsome. A Korean Heathcliff. A librarian sex god. A dad I'd like to, you know. He looks as good as a champagne truffle tastes.
Wow. Then why on earth aren't you, you knowing him?
I sigh. To be honest, I'd really like to, you know, with him, like ASAP. But he suggested we have a friendship because of where I live, usually, and my mom's Springa and everything. And he is probably right, because he is much more than a pretty face. He has just the loveliest way about him, and he enjoys books almost as much as me, and we share a lot of the same passions and values. I think about how easy Daniel is to be with, the quiet way he elicited so much of my history from me over the course of the ball game, how I found myself telling him about John's leaving and the hardest moments afterward, and how he turned away from the batter with a full count to look at me warmly and say, "Amy, you are one tough cookie to live through all that." And the way some combination of that little bit of praise and the tenderness in his eyes made me feel so understood. It was a dangerous bit of magic that zipped between us. The end of the summer would be a killer blow if we let things get carried away. Matt frowns. So you're trying to protect yourselves? I nod. But you still plan to hang out with him socially and spend time together? I nod again. Matt makes a face. What? I ask him. I think you'd better look at that Pinterest board I made. I shake my head. I don't need to date. I've got a full schedule of good stuff, and now I have two new friends in town to hang out with whenever I want a buddy. I tip my head to him, new friend number one, warmly. Plus, I loved that yoga Pilates combo class you sent me to, so I'm definitely going back there a few times a week. And I was thinking I'd add a spin class, too. Do they still have those? I used to love indoor cycling before I had Joe. Matt reaches across the table and grabs my hand. He looks me in the eyes and pauses dramatically. Flywheel, he tells me somberly, as though he is telling me the secret of eternal life. Is that what they call spinning now? He scoffs. Flywheel is so much more than spinning. It's music and lights and competition and challenge. It's a fitness revelation that will change you on the inside and out. His voice has gone quiet and reverent, but then he almost shouts, "There's a class tonight, 6:30 p.m. There is a momentary pause, and then he snaps his fingers. "We need to go buy you the shoes." "I don't need special shoes. I can just wear sneaks." "And padded gear." "Is this contact stationary cycling?" "Quick, eat your gruel," he tells me. "I have to be back in the office by 2, so we only have an hour to shop." I wolf down the generous half teaspoon of avocado on my plate, and then the wild rice. While I eat, Matt's thumbs work furiously on his phone. "What are you up to over there?" I ask him. "I'm live-tweeting your mom, Springa," he tells me blithely. I roll my eyes. No one wants to hear about my fitness regimen. "Oh, no?" he asks and shows me his phone. "Click the hashtag." I do, and I see it. People are talking about hashtag MomSpringa, specifically about how badly they want one. "Huh. The people have spoken," he says, "and they want MomSpringa. You've started a conversation, and my job is to keep it going." With that, Matt and I rush to an athletic store near his office. Inside, we find miles of high-end spandex and stainless steel and many mirrored surfaces. Matt sits me down in the shoe section and barks, "Shimano's, size 7, to the attendant, and then tells me, "Be right back. What's your sports bra situation?" I smile at him, feeling assured in my attire for once. "In that department, I am well covered," I say, adding what I hope is a reassuring thumbs up. In fact, until I came to New York, sports bras were pretty much all I owned. Matt comes back about 2 minutes after I've put on a pair of rigid-soled, low-profile cycling shoes. He is clutching lots of hangers with stretchy gray and black things on them. "How do they feel?" he asks me about the shoes. "Like weird bike shoes? But they fit. Tell me again why I can't wear regular running shoes." "Well, for one thing, you'll slip off the pedals. For another, you look cooler in these. You don't mind that a photographer is meeting us at the cycling studio tonight, do you?" I give him a hard look. I do, in fact, mind. I haven't been on a bike seat of any kind since I pushed my son's enormous head through my tiny birth canal. I will need a few practice sessions to acclimate. He waves a hand as if to say no problem.
Let's do the shoot next week, when you're in the zone. Tonight, we can just tweet and snap. Now, get those off so we can check out and I can get to work before Talia's voicemail explodes. On the way, pick out a water bottle.
He gestures to a display of nozzle-top sports bottles in shades of metallic. Am I going to be shooting water into my mouth while I pedal, like a Tour de France rider? Matt smiles.
Hopefully. It'll make good art.
When we get to the register, I offer to pay for the gear, thinking that this is a good use for some of the last semester's tuition money that John has, miraculously, reimbursed me for over the last week. But Matt shoves me aside.
First of all, the total is going to make your eyes bleed,
he tells me as he pulls out the company credit card.
And second, I still haven't spent all the mom's spring budget.
I frown at him.
But before you go through the motions of arguing with me, only to lose, let's just say we get some great photos of you trying new fitness classes and doing some other new activities.
I narrow my eyes at this last bit, but he ignores me.
The Momspringa hashtag is trending, as you may have noticed. This is one of those rare moments when a story might actually help sell copies of the magazine, or at least raise our profile. That is definitely worth a sweat-wicking tank or two. But did I mention thank you for helping my career? Matt says. And shut up and be grateful for this?
I laugh and then give up and let him pay. As he's being rung up, I play back the previous conversation. What other new activities? I ask him. Pole dancing? Matt laughs.
Oh, please, no one does that anymore.
I shrug.
I'm pretty sure strippers do. Fair enough. But I was thinking dating.
I sigh. Well, I guess I could try a date if there was someone you thought was really promising.
Good.
Matt nods. He takes the bag of gear and we start for the door.
But what would you say about maybe sampling a little more widely?
I look at him curiously.
I guess I'd say, what's the point?
If I hit it off with the guy you pick, then I can date him. If not, I'm not exactly in the mood to shop for a stepdad for the kids. Matt steers me down the crowded sidewalk.
There are other reasons to date besides husband hunting.
Oh, not you two.
It's fun, he tells me.
And it sells magazines. I throw up my hands. And yeah, maybe I give in a little too easily.
Okay, fine. A couple of dates. But you have to do all the picking men and arranging plans, and you have to help me decide what to wear. I just show up. Understand? I understand completely. A couple dates a week until the magazine goes to press.
Thanks, Amy. You're a real peach. I did not agree to that, I tell him.
I said, and I'll text you where to meet tonight for spin class. Me and my new gal pal Amy, hanging at Flywheel, says Matt. Your mind is going to be blown, Matt. Momspringa,
he hollers. And then he turns and walks into the office, leaving me on the street, wondering if what I've actually embarked on is a Momageddon. Chapter 12. Dear Mom, you'll never believe this, but I went to the library yesterday after my first day at work and checked out A Tale of Two Cities. And you're right, I loved it. It was totally unputdownable. I was rooting for Los Angeles the whole time, but when Chicago pulled out a win in the end, I was totally satisfied with the result.
Just kidding.
I went to see the new Fast and the Furious movie with Brian and Trinity. Brian has this friend, Mom, who is so cute. His name is a pretend rich kid name, Dalton. He goes to Catholic school, and he's apparently very good at sports. Brian and his soccer coach are trying to get him to forfeit a year of games to come play his senior year at Country Day. Dalton took me aside when Brian was talking to the bros and asked me what I really thought about that idea. And I told him the truth, that it's a great school, and if he wants to work hard, he'll get an excellent education for 2 years. But you can get a great education lots of places if you're interested in working hard. I said, if he wants to play soccer, play soccer. Don't sit a year out just to make some rich guys happy. He told me the rich guys are persuasive. He told me they have been inviting him to parties and introducing him to hot private school girls. I told him we hot private school girls are actually total prudes and all we do is study all the time. I told him if he wanted to have any kind of post-high school athletic career, he'd be wise to skip the parties and focus on school and practice. He asked me if I wanted to be study buddies. Then Brian came back. I had the best night. I'm pretty sure Dalton is going to stick with his school, and that's probably the right decision for him. But still, it is so, so good to be reminded that there are other guys in this world than the guys I already know. Maybe one day I'll meet a man who knows not to ever take me to a Fast and the Furious movie. Dare to dream, right? Love, your daughter, who is seriously thinking about playing the field. Get it? Soccer field? Because Dalton plays soccer? Corey. Yes, I have two new friends, and Lena and Talia are a text message away, and there's the city that never sleeps for company. But staying alone for weeks at Talia's place is still making me itchy all over. This is not my house. These are not my things. This is not my life. For the first lonely week, I texted Corey too much, called to check on Joan every night, and made Lena or Talia video chat me during dinner so I didn't constantly have to eat alone. But Lena told me last night she'd be appearing as teacher rep for a PTA meeting this evening. Talia has dinner with some advertisers, and Joe and John are chauffeuring Corey and Brian to the movies. So tonight I come home from my third flywheel class, sweaty, exhausted, and totally amped up, and I have never, ever felt so alone. Before class, Matt's people fancied up my ponytail into a high bun and did some sweat-resistant makeup. And then a photographer came in and took pictures of me on the stationary bike, pretending to be part of a larger class. She stayed and snapped some shots while the class was actually going, and I was the subject of all kinds of interest and speculation from my fellow flyers. And I felt, ever so slightly, like a celebrity. Flywheel may be a fitness revelation, but it is also a very New York-y scene. The obscenely toned instructors wear pop star headsets and play music so cool it won't reach my hometown for another 3 years. In the crowded stadium where we spin, with the teacher telling us we are superstars and our sweat flying on the jumps, I feel gorgeous, strong, unbeatable. Now, in the empty Talia-less apartment, I feel more like an imposter. I pour myself a bowl of cereal and then start spinning my mental wheels. I should take a shower, I think, go down to the cute little Italian restaurant on the corner and eat a big plate of gnocchi at the bar by myself. I can bring a book. If I do it with confidence, no one will think anything of it. But instead, I pour the milk on my cereal. I'm not the kind of person who can go sit alone in a restaurant on a Friday night with confidence. I'm the kind of person who will probably eat this cereal and then fall asleep on the couch in my sweat-wicking athletic clothes around 9 p.m. I could be doing that in Pennsylvania, I nag myself, or Antarctica for that matter. I need to live. This is my mom Springa, right? I open up my laptop. After he tweeted my first gussied-up after shoot, Matt fielded a small passel of probably crazy men asking for my contact information so they could date me. He asked them to send a recent photo or link to their online dating profile, and then he'd pass it along to me. He also heard from loyal magazine readers who wanted to set me up with their single guy friends. He followed the same MO with them. Now, he has shared a small private Pinterest portfolio of fellows that I can either thumbs up or thumbs down on. Like my own personal Bumble app, he tells me. I reply, "What's Bumble?" Matt sighs. I haven't looked at the Pinterest board since that quick viewing at the tea house. I've been afraid just looking over these guys would upset me. The truth is, since John left, the idea of dating widely has been almost poisonous to me. The hot librarian aside, there hasn't been anyone, not one single man, who has made me want to get back out there again. The first time Lena brought up dating after John left, I raced to the bathroom, locked the door behind me, and had a big cry before I came back out again. At the time, I blamed the reaction on PMS and fear. On reflection, I suppose the very thought of dating outside my marriage made John's and my separation all too real to bear. Well, now things are different. Now I need to make that separation feel as real as possible if I'm ever going to get on with my life. So I open Pinterest, navigate to the secret board Matt shared with me, and take a look. What I see is amazing. At home, I have gone 3 years without ever bumping into a tempting dating proposition. Here in New York, the talent is unmissable. Here are 20 men, all vetted by Matt, all looking imminently eligible. He's provided links to Facebook to stalk them, and I see doctors and lawyers, artists and poets, and several Wall Street types in a variety of cultural backgrounds, body types, and racial makeups. In their pictures, they are hiking up mountains, scuba diving, and cuddling adorable children. The easy part is the first elimination. I rule out a man with 4 young kids, probably great, but contrary to the ethos of Mom Springa, and a man whose politics on Facebook are just way too incompatible with mine. I rule out a guy riding a Harley with no helmet. If I wanted to be a young widow, I'd just smother John in his sleep. I rule out a guy who seems to have spray-painted himself orange. Now I am left with 16 truly good-looking employed dudes who want to take me on a date. I feel like The Bachelorette, special middle-aged edition. There are too many delicious choices, I text Matt, completely out of nowhere. He must still be at the office. He immediately writes back, "Get 3 dips then. Life is short." I laugh to myself. I'm talking about men, not ice cream. I shoot back. He responds, "Maybe I am too." I send him a smiley and then ask how to choose. Matt, give the guys a ranking of either 1, 2, or 3. Then try to set up dates with all the ones. Scheduling will determine who you meet first. Amy, oh, wow, you had a pretty quick answer for that. Matt, I've done this before. Amy, are you some kind of mom pimp? Matt, I could be. Next career. Amy, I'll be sure to write you a testimonial. Then I pause for a second and text him again. Should the ones be the people who are the best sounding humans or the guys who are the cutest? Matt, up to you. But if it were me, I'd pick the cute ones. You can date nice guys back in PA. New York is just for fun. Amy, hashtag Mom Springa. Matt, hashtag Mom Springa. I turn back to my screen. The man who is a successful pianist is a definite one. I have always wanted to date a musician. Think of his fingers. And the very good-looking Wall Street suit is a one because, wow, he is very good-looking. And the younger one with the gorgeous eyes who says his favorite book is Love in the Time of Cholera. And the silver fox who looks like what you'd get if you crossed Harry Bosch with Walt Longmire. And definitely the archaeologist because Indiana Jones. And so on and so forth. I rate and rate and rate. By the end, I have 7 ones. I open up a beer to pair with my cold cereal, pour it in a glass like a classy person, and start tapping out quick messages. I thank each guy for contacting Matt and tell them I am going to try some first dates as part of the hashtag Mom Springa article. I think that clearly sends the message that this isn't a serious endeavor. Then I ask them if they might be free in the next couple of weeks and if they'd be comfortable going on the record for the magazine. By the bottom of the beer, I have contacted all 7 guys. I am genuinely excited. I am incredibly hopeful. I am downright giddy. And when one of the guys, a financial analyst, pings me back an hour later asking for a date tomorrow night if it's not too short of notice, I am pretty damn pleased with myself to boot. Lena, so how was the date with the money guy? Amy, it was fine. Talia, but was he fine? Amy, Okay, yes. Tall, extremely good looking. Like, maybe he is an underwear model, wearing what I imagine a $1,000 suit would look like. Not that I would know. And he took me to this place where only good-looking people in $1,000 suits go. Like, I felt afraid someone was going to ask me to wear a paper bag on my head to keep the standards up. Lena.
Ha! Ma'am, I apologize, but would you mind hiding your hideousness from us for a few hours? We need to think of our guests' needs.
Amy. Our very good-looking guests. And then my date would say, she doesn't mind. She's one of those with the inner beauty. Talia. You damn well better still have the outer beauty, too. I spent a lot of my August feature budget on that outer beauty. Are you keeping up with your eyebrows? Did he like your hair? Amy. Yes, he said my hair is what drew him to me, which is, like, not really the best thing to say on a first date. I didn't tell him the reason I decided to message him is because of his nice teeth, did I? Lena.
Does he have nice teeth? Because that is not nothing.
Amy. His teeth are like a toothpaste commercial. Little rows of mother-of-pearl shells, gleaming white for as far as the eye can see. Lena.
So he has good oral hygiene habits.
Amy. I would say it's beyond good habits. It's probably closer to a life pursuit than a habit.
Lena. Like a calling from God?
Talia.
What's his name?
Amy.
Dylan.
Talia.
Dylan, this is God. Go get your teeth bleached.
Amy. That's probably exactly what happened. Anyway, it was pretty hypnotizing to look at. I think that's why I ordered that second martini.
Lena. Talia, she got the second martini.
Talia. Stop shouting. Only the voice of God gets to use all caps.
Lena. Talia, she got the second martini.
Talia.
I know, right?
Did you get laid, Amy Byler? Amy.
I did not, but it was hard to resist him.
Lena. She's doing it wrong. She's trying to resist him.
Talia.
I know. Believe me, I know.
Amy. He looked gorgeous and the restaurant was amazing and he was kind of fascinating in his own right with his stories about traveling all over the world, giving out IMF loans. But...
Lena.
Yes?
Amy. Deep down, he was a tool. Do we still say tool?
Talia.
We do, in the privacy of text convos with other people our age.
Lena.
I never said tool.
Amy. That's because you never dated a tool. You were married to God.
Lena.
There were days when God felt like a real tool to me.
Talia.
Wow. You have to let us know how many other nuns you meet in hell, Lena.
Lena.
Oh, like you won't get there long before me?
Talia. I'm in hell now.
Hell is summer in Florida.
Amy.
Hell is realizing your gorgeous tooth model date is a tool only after the second martini. I spent the entire period from the serving of the main course till the escaping to a cab, trying not to tell him how patronizing he was being. He acted like he invented microloans. Also, he asked me if I had read the new Malcolm Gladwell, which, yes, I have. And then even after I said yes, he described the entire book basically verbatim to me. Like, maybe I read it, but did I read it with the Dylan-level insight he could share with me?
Talia.
Ugh.
Malcolm Gladwell.
Amy. Right? I'm a librarian. Dig deeper, jerk.
Lena.
You New York girls are snobs. I think she should have slept with him. I mean, I would have, assuming he'd been a woman.
Amy.
I would rather have slept with a woman.
Lena.
There's plenty of chances for that.
Talia.
No need to switch teams. There are so many more men where Dylan came from. Matt sent me the six packs today. Amy is drowning in prospects. When's your next date, Ames?
Amy. Sigh. Tomorrow night.
Talia. Excellent.
Lena.
Two dates in 3 days? Amy, you're a tiger.
Amy.
Rawr.
He's a doctor. He's taking me to a pop-up dinner with some celeb chef I've never heard of. We've texted a little, and he actually seems pretty promising. He hasn't mansplained anything to me yet, and he told me my kids sounded wonderful, and that meant I was probably wonderful too. Swoon. Talia. Doctors. Lena. At the very least, you'll get a good meal. Amy. Excellent point. Last night I had oysters to start, then a pretty delicious salad thing with melon and crisped prosciutto, then scallops, then the world's most perfect Meyer lemon cake. To say nothing of the two very strong martinis. Lena. And you still didn't put out? Talia, this girl. Talia. A true princess. Amy. Trust me, ladies, I did the right thing. I would have spent the entire episode worried about chipping his beautiful teeth. Talia. Pro tip, if teeth are getting chipped, you're doing sex wrong. Lena. Cut her some slack, T. It's been a long time since she got laid on the regular. Maybe back when she last had a sex life, wooden clubs were involved. Amy. I'm putting my phone on silent, you guys. Talia. That's cool. We don't need you around to make fun of you. Amy. Good night, you monsters. Lena. Good night, your majesty. The next time I come home from Flywheel alone, I take a shower, put on a pretty gray maxi dress that's low enough cut to make me feel just a smidgen indecent, and head right back out the door. No more Ms. Cereal for dinner. Tonight, I'm going to be bold and treat myself to a restaurant I read about in the New Yorker, a place that infuses everything meaningful about the current New York food scene into a tagine and a bowl of olives. They don't take reservations, and I'm expecting to be cooling my heels at the bar for hours, but when I tell them I'm looking for a table for just one, the hostess positively beams at me. It turns out dining here is at communal tables, and they love to fill every single stool at their wide, distressed oak high tops that radiate from an open kitchen. So I get wedged between a rowdy party of five investment bankers and a couple on a date. Listening in on their various conversations is so fun, I end up taking twice as long with the menu as I should, and when the server comes the second time, I finally just ask her to order for me.
Oh, she says. Fun. Parameters?
The restaurant is relaxed, homey, and the pricing is reasonable. New Moroccan is what the review called it. I'm not afraid of anything, I tell her. I'll take your best salad, your favorite main course, and a glass of the perfect drink to go with each of them.
Look at me throwing around money like an oil heiress.
And I can do it guiltlessly at least this one time, because John offered to buy the kids new school shoes that will save me twice the cost of this dinner. The server looks at me sideways.
I've got 100 favorites, but I'll do my best. Or,
she leans in closer.
Chef might cook you something special, you know, if I tell him what you just told me.
I color. Three of the banker's heads have twisted around at the word chef. That would be amazing, too. I'm sure I'll be happy either way.
I'll make sure of it,
she tells me, then gives me the sneakiest little wink when the man on the date next to me waves at her and hollers,
Miss,
as though she's 10 feet away. The server takes my menu and turns her attention to the couple, and I pull out my e-reader, which is loaded with a new Ann Patchett book I've been saving for just such a sumptuous occasion. I don't waste Patchett books, but this place and this adventure of dining alone for the first time in my life is Patchett-worthy. Miss Patchett's words are soon joined by a creamy, tender finishing white wine and a salad of sweet, fresh carrots, toasted crunchy chickpeas, mint, and a honey and vinegar dressing of some kind with just a bit of spicy heat. I eat and eat, and when I have polished off the very last chickpea, I wait until all my table mates are busy with their own food, and then lift the plate to my lips and lick up the last bit of sticky, spicy dressing shamelessly. I put it down and check to see no one caught me, but I am found out by someone in the central kitchen, no less, and wearing whites. He nudges the chef and says something to him, and then points at me. I try to look away, but the chef, a big, bald, tattooed man I wouldn't want to meet in a biker bar, puts down his bar mop, and steps through the little hatch in the half wall between him and us.
So,
he tells me in a thick accent that I can only place somewhere deep in the burrows.
You like the salad?
I blush, but then quickly decide to quit simpering. I'll never see any of these people again, and I look really good in this dress, which has been confirmed by the occasional sideways leer of an investment banker 10 years my junior. I like the salad, and I hope you'll make me something special to follow it up, I tell him.
How do you like lamb?
I like it very much.
Are you in a hurry?
He asks me, tilting his head to the people on either side of me, who are silent, watching us with interest. Not at all, I tell him.
Good, then come sit over here.
The man starts to walk back to the kitchen, but stops and puts me at an open bar seat right in front of him.
It is boring tonight. All very timid chicken eaters who read about me in the New Yorker.
I read about you in the New Yorker. He smiles.
And I thought you just stumbled in here from the street. I'm getting you some gray wine.
That sounds awful, but I nod and brace myself. What I get is thankfully not gray at all, but more of a pinkish pour with a dry rosé meat citrus sort of flavor. The bottle is cool and sweaty, and my server pours a second glass for the chef, and he pours a good taste for her, and then they leave the entire remainder of the bottle sitting by me to work on as he cooks. I forget my book and watch him work. He's relaxed and quiet, and he often pokes his staff with an elbow by way of communication rather than sparing a word. The tickets move past him with such speed. I see about five of the same exact dish, looking indistinguishable from one another, go out over and over and over again. I crane back and see the bankers ordering more wine, see the couple get their check. I keep watching and waiting, and sometimes the chef puts a tiny spoon of food up on my bar spot for me to taste. One olive, a sliver of preserved lemon, a rich, briny tomato sauce that seems only distantly related to an Italian ragu. Finally, after who knows how long, just as I notice I am getting hungry and my glass is almost empty, a plate comes up for me. It's a ring of alternating quartered soft-boiled eggs and tiny lamb meatballs, making a shoreline for a moat of tomato and fava bean sauce with bright green olive tapenade on top. Standing upright in a little jar next to the plate are fried, stuffed sardines. I stare at the plate, then up at the chef.
Eat now,
he urges me. I comply, and it's phenomenal. Everything tastes of some smoky spice I've never tasted before, plus the brightest, best version of tomato, parsley, lamb, egg. I could eat the sardines like French fries. I take a bite of the second one and dip it in the sauce on my plate, and the chef nods approvingly. He's busy. He hardly talks to me for the rest of my meal, but he constantly reaches up and pours another inch of vinaigre into my never-empty wine glass, and when I've eaten every last bite of the kofta and sardines, he says something to my server. And she comes back in 10 minutes with a large slice of rosewater and pomegranate pie. I do my best with that, but by the time my check is paid, I am uncomfortably full and very comfortably tipsy. My thanks to the chef and my server are sloppy and gratuitous, and I make a slow, careful path out to the street. It is late for me, but not for New York. Everyone is going somewhere. People are on dates, people are kissing quickly in passing, or for long, unabashed hellos. I would like, I think, to be kissing a long, unabashed hello to someone. I would like to be going somewhere. Not back to Talia's, but to see someone I could tell all about this stupendous dinner and the gray wine and the semi-famous, quiet, yet whimsical chef. I don't want to waste this perfect combination of satisfied and intoxicated. I want to walk up a long, endless avenue and talk and talk and talk until the sun comes up, because this is New York and I am on vacation and life is so very, very good. Needless to say, I text Daniel. Chapter 13. Dear Mom, okay, full disclosure, this is turning out to be an amazing summer. First things first, I dumped Brian. He was hassling me about sex stuff. Also, he's just not a great guy. I was super nice about it. I texted and called for follow-up. I told him it was because I needed to focus on diving. He didn't believe me, so I told him it was because I didn't want to have sex with him. Then he was quiet. He asked me if I was a lesbian. I just said, maybe, because it seemed nicer than telling him he was revolting. So that was huge, because now I have more time to hang with Dad, who is just turning out super cool as he starts to relax and not be quite so obvious about trying to buy our love. He's really a good listener, really non-judgmental, because he's pretty much been as big a screw-up as a person can be already. It's easy to talk to him about my real feelings about some things, like guys, or how I don't actually like that many of the girls from my diving team, or how I sometimes feel poor at our school, even though I know I'm lucky to have clean water and shoes that fit and contact lenses. When I'm talking to Lena or my friends, I want them to like me, so I don't always tell the straight truth. Dad obviously thinks Joe and I are God's gift to Bucks County, Pennsylvania, no matter what we say. Also, Dad is super into adolescence. He says I should lean into it and label my feelings and embrace them. I told him not to worry about that. He says unpleasant emotions will pass through me faster if I name them and feel them. I was like, Dad, welcome to stuff I learned on Sesame Street. He said, my generation never learned anything important like that. And he told me that's part of the reason he didn't handle his problems well. Is that true? You seem to know how to have most feelings. I guess you're a little low in the anger department. You never got very angry at Dad, and you can be kind of a martyr sometimes, and then suddenly blow up at me for no reason except stupid stuff like spending Joe's bus fare on Diet Coke and then telling him to walk home. He was 10. It was only 3 miles. If you let me have Diet Coke in the house, that never would have happened. Anyway, if you had just let rip on Dad and gotten angry, it would have made me and Joe feel a lot better. We thought we might be horrible people for hating him so much at first. Lena says you were protecting us from painful truths about our father. But I think if you had told us what he told us this summer, that he was being kind of a shitty dad to us and things were only getting worse and he was making you unhappy all the time, then we would have understood things a bit better. IDK, I'm not trying to pile on here. I'm just saying. Love, your daughter, Corey, who read 0 books this week, but did look at a J. Crew catalog and gives it 2 stars for inventiveness of sweater color names. Amy. Hey, it's late. I'm still up. You want to meet for a drink? Daniel doesn't write back. I wander around in widening loops through Talia's neighborhood, circling her apartment like a shark. I don't want to go back there. I don't want to put on the old soft lavender t-shirt I sleep in and climb into bed and read myself to sleep like I do every other night. I want to live. I want to taste every bite of the cookie of life. I want to... Daniel.
Hello to you too. I'm just finishing up dinner with much cooler than me friends on the Lower East Side. I need an antidote to all this ironic facial hair.
Amy. I don't have even non